Today's Teisho will be on case one in the Book of Serenity. Case one is entitled, The World Honored One Ascends the Seat. Introduction. Closing the door and sleeping is the way to receive those of highest potential. Looking, reflecting, and stretching is a roundabout way for the middling and lesser. How can it bear sitting on the carved wood seat sporting devil's eyes? If there is any bystander who doesn't agree, come forward. You can't blame him either. Case, one day the world honored one ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. The world honored one then got down from his seat. Verse, the unique breeze of reality, do you see? Continuously creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. Today is day four of our wonderful January session. And some of you arrived last night, and I'm so glad to see you. I'm very glad you're here. And in the previous days, we've been sitting long and getting tired and working very hard on our koans. I'm sure you will be in that same place sometime tomorrow. So thank you so much for coming. And thank you all for doing such an excellent job in the Zendo this morning. It's so important to start the day like that, right? We get up early before the sun. We sit down and we go into deep mushin. You know, when people were calling mu, that was coming from a very deep place. It's definitely the case that some of you are calling mu in the Dokusan room. And you might think that it's very arbitrary, you know. But I can tell when somebody is really basically emptying themselves out, making themselves small, and allowing that energy of mu to flow through their bodies. It's a qualitatively different response. And so I assure you, if you're doing it, you know, everybody who does that feels a little foolish at first, you know. Everybody who does it feels, it's ridiculous in a way, right? You're coming into this room and you're calling mu, and you know, that's on the face of it very weird. You wonder what the people who maintain the grounds here think. You know, some people screaming at the top of their lungs. You know, Zen is supposed to be serene, right? You know, there's people screaming at the top of this lungs like cows, right? It just sounds like moo. What's that about? You know. But a very important practice. You know, it's actualizing. You know, the first part of the mu koan is just being able to get to emptiness. And at first it seems trivial, just like a little blankness there. As you continue to return there, it sort of expands. It becomes more all-encompassing. And then eventually, you know, you are able to be in that place for a rather lengthier periods of time. And that is so incredibly important. You know, in reality, if you meditate long enough, one day, if you're in very deep samadhi, you'll notice that our perception of reality, and maybe it's reality itself, isn't really continuous. You know, so the mind can really only focus on one thing at a time. Or you, another way to put it is, awareness happens in little packages. It's like you hear a sound, and you're aware of that, and then you feel the cold on your face. And then you feel the pain in your leg, and then you hear another sound. That's if you really are concentrating, you'll notice that each moment of awareness has just one aspect, one content, you know. Each moment of awareness is a kind of discrete. And at first, they all seem to flow. It just seems like you hear the sound, you feel the pain in your leg, you wonder when is he going to ring the bell, then somebody's sniffling next to you or blowing his nose, and then you feel the pain in your leg. It all just seems to flow, but actually, if you meditate long enough, it's not a flow. It's like there's these little events sort of are happen like a flash, and then they go away, and then they flash, and then they go away. And in between those moments of awareness, there are these empty spaces, really and truly. You have to be, this will happen to you if you practice diligently for many years. One day you'll be sitting and you'll just say, oh, damn it, he was right, you know? It's really like that, you know? You'll see there's a flash and then blankness and flash and then blankness and then flash and then blankness. And in fact, you know, this is widely known in the world of Buddhism, you know. One way people talk about the moments succeeding each other is that they talk about like waves. So each moment is like a little wave, and then it recedes, and then there's a trough, a wave and a trough, and those troughs are empty. You know, so basically, we think the world is pure presence, but it's not. If you're in a very, very deeply concentrated state, eventually you'll notice that presence and absence, or presence and emptiness, are actually like the wave and the troughs of this world. And, you know, human consciousness is too crude, ordinarily, for people to... It would be amazing if we were aware of this from birth, but we're not. You know, unfortunately, our awareness is too crude, you know, to catch this, because we're so distracted, we're so easily distracted. But eventually, if you really practice, Zen, and you persistently do this, and you get into deep samadhi over and over again, you'll notice that there's something, and then there's this emptiness, and then there's something in this, and it's like wave and trough. And so, you know, when we're doing mu practice, it might seem just totally nuts, you know. Like, what is this? You know, when you follow your breath out, you know, eventually your mind becomes stable, eventually you start working with the mu koan, and you're sitting there going, moo, 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 moo. And then, you know, you begin to notice that your mind becomes blank, right? Your mind actually gets to be blank. And then the teacher says, please come in and call moo, right? And it's, the whole thing is occult and mysterious. But, you know, when you discover, when you're calling moo and suddenly you notice that your mind is blank, you are actually discovering those intervals of emptiness between the waves, really. And so you're starting to step out of, you know, most people just, it's like looking at, all you see is the waves. You don't see the troughs. So we only get half the picture. And this is not philosophy. This is how, if you practice for a long time, reality actually appears. You know, so most people look and all they see is the waves. They don't see the troughs, the spaces. So we have a very incomplete picture. And ordinary consciousness is so distracted that it's very difficult to liberate ourselves from that incorrect picture of the world. So mu sounds like the craziest thing in the world, you know, calling mu. But it's really a strategy designed to help you to see what the mind ordinarily leaves out. But it's there all the time, as you'll begin to see if you keep practicing. You know, in the old days, before there was digital projection on movie theaters, there was something. Actually were rolls of film, and there were actual projectors. I don't know. Some younger people might never have actually seen one of these machines, but basically, they project. There's a bulb in behind the screen, and I'm sorry. There's a bulb in the projector, and it projects this funnel of light into this magnifier. This lens, and it greatly focuses and intensifies the light. It's a very powerful bulb anyway, and the light shoots through a film, and it projects down into the theater onto the screen, and basically you used to have these reels that would play, would roll, and frame after frame goes in front of the light, and the beam of light projects it onto the screen. Well, what would happen is, you know, when I was growing up, sometimes the motion of the tape was too slow, and the light is so powerful, it'll burn the film. So you had to keep that moving at a certain speed, or it would actually burn the plastic film. And every once in a while, you go to a movie theater, and it would just burn through the film, and all of a sudden, you'd be watching, you know, somebody's about to kiss somebody, and then there's a blank screen, right? Another problem that would happen would be sometimes the projector would have like some lint in the turning unit. So all of a sudden, instead of having these smooth images, you begin to get flashes, like, you know, the stagecoach. You see the stagecoach, and then there's a blank, and then you see the stagecoach, and then there's a blank, and then you see the stage. Well, that is actually very much how reality will appear if you're really deeply concentrated and you practice a long time. So the mu koan is saying, please go into that blankness. And if you begin, you start your career in Zen, you begin to get a different picture of the world, because half of what we see is missing from reality. And it's because our mental habits are not focused enough. We can't slow down enough to really notice how reality is unfolding in front of us. So, this is a long way of saying, trust me, mu is not a crazy thing. And when you go in to call mu in the Dokusan room, I'm trying to see how deeply and how long you've been in that trough. And being in that trough actually does change you. It really does. It's very purifying to be in that emptiness. In the West, we don't like emptiness. You know, we tend to think, we always say something is better than nothing. You know, he's only going to pay me $7.50 for doing this job per hour, but, you know, something is better than nothing. You know, but actually, not necessarily so, right? So when you're in deep emptiness for a while, it begins to have this transformative effect. For one thing, you begin to see things differently, right? Everything begins to come alive. You know, if you, on day three of Sesshin, you know, you begin to get into that deep depth, that blankness more persistently. And, you know, at one point, you may notice, you know, that, you know, you look outside and you see the wind blowing in the leaves, and it's just so beautiful. or it's just it moving. You know, it can move you to tears. You know, move you to tears. That experience of intensity is something that begins to happen to people when they add back this missing element of their lives. You know. It's a different world on day 3 of Sesshin, right? And day 4 of Sesshin, when you've added back the emptiness into your life, and you're getting a different. It's a different world. The whole world comes alive when you do this. So, this koan is the first koan in the Book of Serenity. And it's an interesting koan. I mean, on the face of it, it doesn't make any sense at all. First of all, it never really happened in history. So in the koan it says, one day the world-honored one, that's the Buddha, ascended the seat. Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma of the King of Dharma. The Dharma of the King of Dharma is thus. And then everybody is supposed to look at the Buddha, and then the Buddha got down from his seat, and that's the end of the story. So you think, what's that all about? So he's the Buddha. Yeah, I understand. He's important, right? He's a big shot, you know. So why would that be in this koan collection? And maybe you could say, naturally it's a Buddhist book. You know, we're supposed to respect the Buddha. We're supposed to admire the Buddha. And maybe if you were working with this koan, that's how you might take it. You know, you might sit down and say, the Buddha ascends the seat, you know. And in a certain sense, you know, we'd all like to ascend the seat. We'd all like to, I mean... one of my favorite scenes in a movie, Pan's Labyrinth. I don't know if you've seen it, but this little girl is basically killed, and in her dying moments, she has always dreamed that her mother was a princess and her father was a king, and she's done this heroic deed that leads to her death. But before she dies, she wakes up and she's in a throne room, and her mother's on one throne and her father's on the other throne, and she's being applauded by everybody in the throne room, you know. And this is such a wonderful moment, you know. We all want to be Buddha, you know. We all would like to be revered and respected, you know. That's a normal and very healthy human desire, right? When the Dalai Lama, I mentioned earlier in the week, when the Dalai Lama comes to New York City sometimes, there have been occasions where he's actually given a talk in Central Park, and on one occasion, more than 200,000 people showed up. The Dalai Lama is quite a draw, because people put him on the same level sometimes as almost as the Buddha. And the Dalai Lama actually sits on a throne when he gives his talks. If you know the style of Tibetan Buddhism, they like stuff like that. So, when the Dalai Lama goes to visit, usually in places in America, the community will actually spend time making a throne for him. And they'll all pitch in and they'll make this beautiful throne, and when he comes, he sits on the throne. The Buddha is reverenced, he sits on a throne, and, you know, we all are supposed to, maybe this is in the book because we're all supposed to revere the Buddha who's so high. See, he ascends the throne, we look up at him, and so on. And maybe that's what this koan is all about, but actually, it's a koan, right? So you can never take it at face value, right? It's the first koan in the book, and it's dealing with something really important, but what, you know? And it can't be just, you know, respect the Buddha, that's the message, right? Because that's not a koan, that's just advice or some kind of moral, you know, a religious teaching. Respect the Buddha, okay, great, you know. So where's the hook? Every koan has a hook. It's got to get into your skin somehow and drive you crazy, right? So what's the hook here, right? And so, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you say, ascended the throne, ascended the throne, ascended the throne. And it's possible that you might find yourself, you know, really, you have two responses, right? One might be you adore the Buddha and you visualize him on the throne, but as you work with it for a while, you might begin to feel your distance from the Buddha, right? You know, you know how wonderful he is and how distant I am from the Buddha. You know, how distant, how unlike the Buddha I am. Right? When we're at Sesshin and we're on day three of Sesshin, we may feel very generous and kind. But, you know, people don't always do that. You know, when I was training at, I mentioned earlier in the week that I went to a monastery in upstate New York for a while. And I did some sesshins there to stay in shape while I was trying to finish my book for my job. And it was very interesting to see how people ate, because usually the newbies were at the back of the table. There's like four long tables in this Zen center. And the food is served, of course, here as we do at the front of the table, and it goes down. And people would be taking a lot of food, and by the time it got to the end of the table, there was like nothing left, you know. And it amazed me, really, because I was often at the end of the table. And, you know, there'd just be like, you know, everybody has taken every last piece, you know, and there'd be like a pile of toast, you know, and you know, by the time you got down, there was no toast, you know. It was like, oh, so I don't even have toast to eat, you know, and it was upsetting, you know, not to get any food, right, you know, and you have to think about what were people doing, you know. It's like there's a kind of I think people were kind of feeling, you know, you've been sitting all day, you're at the edge of your abilities, and the food is coming down the table, and you maybe grab too much of it, you know, because you just have to grab something because you feel so desperate, right? And you know, maybe in another moment you'd say, oh my God, that wasn't a very Buddhist-like thing to do. You know, I grabbed the last piece of toast and I tried not to look at that poor guy's face, you know. Especially when I ate it, right? You know? So, you know, we all have moments. You know, you leave the sesshin and somebody cuts you off in traffic and all of a sudden you're angry. You know, so it's definitely the case we can feel our distance from the Buddha. And I definitely think this is a big issue. I mentioned earlier that I've practiced at a number of different places, and it's quite interesting to see competitiveness, right, among people who are supposed to be making themselves small. So, I've been in a couple places I mentioned earlier where different people have different colored rakusus to identify their status in the community. And even in the Seattle Zen Center, which was a very hippie community, you know, there was definitely a sort of a pecking order, and people who were sort of like advanced students, and there were people who were just the newbies, and there was a feeling of inequality there, you know. And the advanced people could be quite, how should I put it, protect, you know, they would sort of hang out, they would be the gatekeepers for the Roshi, let me put it like that. So, you know, if you wanted to talk to the Roshi, you know, basically they'd say, oh, or if you asked a question, someone would say, oh, yes, Genki Roshi, he's just so wonderful, you know, and they'd let you know how close they were to Genki Roshi. And it's interesting to see that kind of competitiveness and a one-upmanship in communities that are supposed to be about letting go of the self, you know. But I think that competitiveness is not something we should look with as contemptuously, or we shouldn't see that competitiveness as evil, right? It's not evil. It's coming from a place of real insecurity or real a sense of inadequacy, you know? It's very human. We all have a dimension of that, right? We'd all like to ascend the high seat. It would be, you know, imagine being the Dalai Lama, you know? You fly into New York. As you go through the airport, people turn to you with a rapt look, right? You know, and you go to Central Park and 200,000 people hang on your every word, right? I mean, wouldn't that be nice, right? You know, I mean, you finally I'm loved, you know. Now finally I'm loved, right? You know, and that's such a human thing, you know. And so, you know, I think that competitiveness, that aggression, and that that sort of one-upmanship you sometimes find in Buddhist communities comes from, not just Buddhist communities, I mean, the English department where I work, you know, but especially in places where you would expect behavior to be different, you find that kind of thing, and I think it comes from a very human place, right? We all want to be, we all want to be loved. We all want to be respected, and so this is sort of the koan, right? You know, if you work with the koan at first, it might not mean very much. But if you work with it more deeply, you know, you might begin to feel, you know, I'll never be a Buddha. You know, I'll never be a Buddha. You know, when you go to these Zen communities where people are sort of hogging the Roshi, you know, they're trying. It's like if the Roshi likes me, I will be worthy of being liked. And especially if other people see me as somebody who the Roshi likes, they will see me as a worthy person. You know, and they don't work it out in their heads. This is all sort of unconscious. And everybody does this, right? I mean, it's a human thing, right? So if you're working with this koan, it might be, you might find yourself getting kind of dejected or sad because you might think, well, you know, I don't ascend any high seat, you know. I don't. When I go to Central Park, nobody notices, you know. In fact, people seem annoyed sometimes. So this is a human thing. It's definitely the case that we all feel, I think, especially in our society, a little bit unworthy, right? You know, feel a little bit unworthy. I mentioned earlier in the week, you know, that our society is much more competitive than we realize. You know, so if you remember going to school, like I went to school in the 1960s, and I remember it as just going to school. The schools were clean, they were well funded, I didn't, except in when I lived in Baltimore, I didn't have to worry about getting beaten up, you know, at least in the building, I didn't have to worry. And you know, I have lots of friends who have really good memories of school, you know, but actually, you know, from the time you enter school until the time you leave, it's very competitive. You're being sent a message, you know, you're the best student, you're the second best student, you're the third best student. And, you know, in a high school class, you know, senior year, you know, somebody gets the valedictorian award, somebody is salutarian, you know, you begin to learn that you're being graded, you know, not just getting grades, but you're being sorted out, you know, this is the triple A egg, this is the double A egg, this is the A, you know, and, you know, people have to adjust, you know, well, I'm just an A egg, you know, he's an AAA, you know. And so I think a lot of people grow up feeling inferior, you know, and I think this koan is talking about that, you know, that experience, which was very common in China, you know. Most Chinese people were made to feel like dirt, actually, really. You know, in classical China, there was a small group of people who were highly literate, who were government bureaucrats, and they're business elite. Sounds like America. But it was, the average person felt very inferior, right? So, you know, maybe one of the reasons this book is starting with this koan is not to make you fall down on your knees and worship the Buddha, but to confront this issue, here's something that happened to me, you know, when I started doing Zen practice, I got into it because I was, I would say, in retrospect, depressed, you know, and I began to sit with Genki Roshi, and I began to feel much, much better. I've mentioned the fact that when I would go to Sesshin and do koan training, I didn't seem to be able to answer any koans. I didn't even seem to be able to answer one koan. So I was working on the breath perception koan. And Genki Roshi gave me this koan, and I was kind of resentful because I thought, well, this is just for babies, you know. I'm not a baby, you know. This is, how does it, in the koan here, it says, closing the door and sleeping is the way to receive those of highest potential. See, highest potential. Looking, reflecting, and stretching is a roundabout way for the middler or lesser. So when Genki Roshi gave me the breath koan, I thought he was treating me like I was middling or lesser. But I knew I had the highest potential, see. So I, you know, my idea was that Genki Roshi just didn't see what a, you know, a star, budding star I was. This sounds, I'm being a little bit hard on myself, but, you know, I had definitely, I treated Zen like a competitive situation in school. And I expected to get A's. I have students who come in to see me, and they'll tell me, you know, I expect to get an A in this class. Well, good, okay, let me write that down. You know. Yes, sir. So, you know, I wanted to get A's in my koan training, you know, and I couldn't answer the breath perception koan, which was the baby koan, you know. So I would keep going into see Genki Roshi, and I was trying to impress him. I was trying to be, a star, you know. And I actually wrote poetry, you know. In our sangha, we don't use the bell because we're in the kitchen. If I rang the bell to end the dokusan, you'd hear all morning would be, or all evening would be the bell ringing. But in a traditional Zen setting, when the teacher wants to end the meeting, he just does that. And you could be mid-sentence, but that's the end. So basically I'd go in to see Genki Roshi, and I would say, he'd say, what's the breath? You know, tell me about the breath. And I'd come in and go, it's all one. And I'd say, and I had this, I wrote poems about, you know, enlightenment, death, you know. I brought the Roshi a flower, I brought the Roshi some stones, you know. I used to have dreams. I just thought, why, you know, why can't I answer this koan? And I remember we had this one koan where I actually, in my dream, I was looking at a wall and suddenly the Buddha came through the wall. And I just thought, my God, that's it, you know. So I came, I went to see the Roshi. I said, Roshi, I had this dream, you know, it was a blank wall, and then the Buddha came. on and on. It was so depressing, you know. I was getting F's. You know, it's like, how can this be happening to me? You know, so then I, we would drive home. We used to have our, before we had our own place, we used to have our temple fairly far away, our practice center, where we used to rent a place like Murray Grove. And we'd drive home and people would say, oh yes, I answered another koan. It's like, oh, you know, everybody's answering their koans but me. And I'm ashamed, I've talked about this before, but I'm ashamed to say there was this woman, Gina, who was this beautiful dancer in our group. And she was, you know, she had an advanced degree in art history. She was a dancer with a dance troupe in Seattle. She was beautiful, and she was answering all her koans, right? So I was driving home with Gina and her then boyfriend, Bill. And Gina says, well, you know, Bill said, did you answer your koan? She said, yes, you know. And he said, well, what was the answer? She said, well, I'm not supposed to tell. But it was the breath perception koan, I think. And he said, what did you tell Genki Roshi? You should never do this. Please don't. But she said, peach. You know. So I went in to see the Roshi. Peach. And it's not just about the grades, right? It's not about grades. It's not about passing koans. It's like, oh, you know, people get so desperate because they feel so unlovable. You know, it's like, I am so unlovable. You know, everybody else is getting love from the Roshi, right? I mean, this is very much a human thing, right? You want to go in. I was thinking I'd go in to see the Roshi, and he'd go, my God, you know, you're my reincarnation of my old teacher, you know. How are you, wise one, you know? This is my special friend, Kurt. You know, he's the reincarnation of my old teacher, you know. I'm so glad to see you again, Master Wong, or something. You know? But none of that happened. I was just a schmo, you know. I couldn't answer any koans, you know. So, basically, I felt very unlovable. So anyway, in our community, we had a different system from here. People would volunteer to be Tenzo, or they'd be actually asked by the Roshi to be the cook for two sesshins. So you'd give up your practice time to prepare food for everybody else. That would be how we would do it. I was going to sesshins regularly and having this unsatisfactory experience. And then the Roshi, unfortunately, called on me. He met with me. The Roshi would like to talk to me. He didn't tell me, you are the reincarnation of my old teacher. He said, I would like you to be the Tenzo. And I thought, oh, shit. You know, now I will never be the great master. I'm going to waste 6 months, basically, in the kitchen cooking. So, you know, I said, oh, of course, you know, yeah, thank you, you know, I didn't mean it. But then I started cooking. And, you know, I had worked on and off in restaurants in my life, you know. I ran a restaurant for a season in a tourist town. And I also cooked in an Italian restaurant, and so I'm actually quite a good cook. And so I just got into cooking, you know. I really decided to do this right. And part of it was competitive. Again, if I'm going to be a Tenzo, I'm going to be the best goddamn Tenzo I've ever seen, you know. But, you know, when I began to really throw myself into cooking, I began to really be interested in making people happy, you know. This really happened to me. You know, I was cooking, and I was trying to just, you know, sort of the one-upmanship, you know. But then I began to cook these meals, and I got really into cooking, you know, like... I made béarnaise sauce for sashimi, you know, and it was delicious. You know, it was like tofu and béarnaise sauce or something like that. But it was absolutely, and you know, I would put this stuff out and I would watch people eating with such joy. You know, it was just like I would peek through the door. It was a little bit like our dining room, only, you know, I could look out at, and they couldn't see me. I could look out that one of those swinging doors and I would watch, and people would like, you could see they were so happy, you know, and they would, and I would always look to see if they'd take, you know, there was nothing left, you know, they'd eaten everything, you know. And really just, it gave me unexpected joy to see people so happy. And I redoubled my efforts, you know, and I actually baked bread, so people had fresh bread, you know, and stuff like that. And, I just, at the end of the whole session, you know, I came in to see Genki Roshi. Called me, and the session was over, and he called me and he said, I want to talk to the Tenzo. And he said, you know, he said, this is, the, and he wasn't being unkind, he just said, this is the first time I have seen you do anything to help other people. And he didn't quite say it like that, but he basically said, this is the first time I have seen you help other people. And he said, and you have done this, you know, with such, so wholeheartedly, that, you know, it's really wonderful to see. And he said, you know, you haven't passed the breath perception koan, but I'm going to pass you anyway, because in a way you've kind of passed it. And he said, I'd like you to go on and work with Mu. You know, that was a beautiful experience for me, right? So anyway, when we were all driving home in the truck, you know, my friends tell me I was saying something, and they said I fell asleep in mid-sentence, right? You know, and I just was I was exhausted from cooking for, you know, 20-some people for 7 days, and or 6 days, whatever it was. And, you know, but that was a real discovery for me, you know, in the... In the Wizard of Oz, there's a terrible, terrible moment where the wizard says to the Tin Woodsman, I think he says this to Dorothy, I can't remember, but he says, it's not whether we love others, but whether we are loved by others. See, he says, it doesn't matter that we love others, it's that whether we're loved by others. But I think that's not good advice. See, I mean, I think it's the other way around. You know, people may or may not love us, but, you know, we have this incredible capacity to love and to be compassionate and generous and giving. And this is the Buddha nature in us, right? When we're going around, as we all do, looking desperately to be loved, right? We don't feel like Buddhas, you know. And in fact, you know, we never will feel like Buddhas if that's our mindset. You know, even if people love us, we won't feel like Buddhas, you know. If you're desperately feeling that you're not a Buddha, you're not worthy of love, even if 200,000 people come to Central Park to hear you, you still won't believe it, you know. And then you'll think, why wasn't it 400,000, you know. In the old days, I used to get 400,000, you know. So, you know, what you discover in yourself, you know, is this, and I think Zen practice really makes this clear, you know, what is enlightenment? Enlightenment is discovering, you know, this in a very powerful and profound way in yourself, you know. that we have this capacity to be kind and generous and loving to people. And it, we might not even believe we have it, you know? I mean, a lot of people are very cynical and they're very scarred. And they, you know, they wouldn't in a million years believe that this is there, but it's really there. You know, so a lot of Buddhist practice is entering Mushin and stripping away all of these, like, the tough outer skin, you know. And at some point, you discover your fundamental tenderness. And that is your Buddha nature. So, you know, this koan at the beginning of the book is sort of dramatizing the problem, right? You know, that we start our practice desperately trying to become Buddhas. And we feel that we're, you know, like a million miles away from that goal. You know, so maybe if, you know, in these big temples, everybody tries to schmooze with the Roshi and so on, and they feel, well, now I'm getting somewhere, I'm getting to be lovable. And you know, that's a common human response to the problem. But the real solution is, you know, you sit on the cushion and you discover, it's often accidentally, you know, this incredible compassion in yourself, this power of overcoming any kind of obstacle, any kind of obstacle. So, closing the door and sleeping is the way to receive the highest potential, those with the highest potential. So when we read that, we either think, ah, yes, I'm the one with the highest potential, or we think, oh my God, I'm not the one with the highest potential. Then looking, reflecting, and stretching is a roundabout way for the middling and lesser. So the introduction is sort of grading, assigning everybody a grade and making our anxiety worse. How can it bear sitting on the carved wooden seat spouting devil's eyes? If there is any bystander who doesn't agree, come forward. You can't blame him either. Case. One day, the world-honored one ascended the seat. Manjushri struck the gavel and said, clearly observe the Dharma king of the Dharma king, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Then the world-honored one got down from his seat. See? Buddha is in you. Buddha is in you. My second teacher always used to say, take good care of yourself. And I never understood what he meant. You know, he meant, you are Buddha. Please take care of yourself. Verse, the unique breeze of reality, do you see? Continuously creation runs her loom and shuttle, weaving the ancient brocade, incorporating the forms of spring. But nothing can be done about Manjushri's leaking. Well, we'll go into leaking some other day. But it's a problem. Leaking is a problem in Buddhism. It means you're not always at your best, you could say. So none of us are always at our best, right? Even when we're not at our best, we can do something, right? We can do something that manifest our compassion.